Hello and welcome to MOAS. Did you know that there are an estimated 3.5 million Rohingya living around the world? Bangladesh is currently home to nearly a million of them, but they live in many different places and their lives and challenges differ greatly, continent to continent. To mark the 20th year of Rohingya Week, the MOAS podcast is speaking to two members of the global Rohingya diaspora. We wanted to learn about what forced them to leave, their journeys, challenges, and their resilience. Both now live in Europe, a place where very few Rohingya manage to reach. They consider themselves lucky.
My village is much affected village in Arakan since 2017, 20th of August.
Abul Kalam is the founder and chairperson of the Swedish Rohingya Association and one of the founding members of the European Rohingya Council. He's been living in Sweden with his wife and children since 2003, but he originally comes from Tulatoli in northern Mongdal, Rakhine State. His connection to the crisis runs deep. Not only did he flee Myanmar twice, 1978 and 84, he's also kept up with his relatives and the people of his village who've recently fled. They're all now in the Bangladesh refugee camps. Witnessing what the Rohingya continue to face, he's been pushing to help them.
Since 25 of August, me and my wife, my two kids, 9 years old and 7 years old, we were getting much disturbed because in social media and other media, they were showing and flooding many pictures, many videos about Rohingya massacre, genocide of Rohingya. Even about my village, we lost more than I collected myself how much dead toll it was in my village. It was 410, including small kids, babies, men, women, and pregnant women, and elderly age slaughtered by Burmese army and Rakhine extremists. I lost many of my relatives. I can't describe how much problem and how much thinking and who we were feeling in our life. And later it was not possible to control ourselves. My wife, she became like a trauma and I became also sick. Then I decided to visit Bangladesh refugee camp to meet our relative, villager and other refugees. I have been 3 times in Bangladesh. The condition when I come here, it was the same condition when I faced myself, my family faced 1978, the same situation. But that time it was not much populated. It was 250,000 Rohingya people migrated into the Bangladesh. Now in the very small area called the Ukia, Kutupalang, Balukali, Dundumia, Nayapara, Leda, and No Man's Land, more than 700,000 people they are living. They are like in open prison. There is a lot of security by Bangladeshi army and other forces and other authorities.
How has living in Sweden made you feel about the crisis for Rohingya as a whole?
In Sweden, I'm thinking a lot of about freedom, right of people, right of children, right of women, men, and elderly people. So I can say here, those who are living in the refugee camp, they are thinking about their future, just how can we back to our home, but not all of these facilities. Not hospital, not school, not other facilities. Being a human, have to right to get. But I feeling much more because I am living in Europe and Sweden is very well facilitated country. So this why night or day, 24 hours, I am thinking about my pupil and their future, especially about education for them. And especially those children who lost their parents, they haven't any right. They have nothing. If I compare with Sweden and other European countries as a orphan, how much they have right in this country. But in the camp, how much difficulty they are facing. No one, there is no one to ask them, did you feed? Did you eat? Did you get the lunch? Did you get the dinner? Have you did you have breakfast? There was no one to ask this kind of question.
What would you say are the biggest challenges you've faced in Sweden?
It's very important to connect to a community and share their difficulties and help them. It is too important for me. We are just 37 families living in Sweden. Much are settled by IOM and UNHCR as a third country settlement from Thailand, from Bangladesh refugee camp, and Malaysia and Indonesia. We Rohingya, I told you already, like a family. All villagers know each other like the family member. As a single family in Stockholm, it is too difficult for me live because I am looking around like Turkish community, like Iranian community, like Somalian people, like from Iraq, like from Kurdistan, like from Syria. They have a lot of people. They can enjoy, they can invite each other, they can meet each other, they can speak, they can share their difficulties at the same time. But unfortunately, we haven't this kind of opportunity because in Stockholm we are just 2-3 families and more family they are living north of Sweden, settled by the United Nations and IOM. So this is very important for me to get a connection with my people because they are looking, they are hoping we some live in European country, we can help them. We can raise their issue. We can try our best for their right, their future, their education, their repatriation back to the homeland. But alone, single, cannot. So this is very important for me, connected all of those Rohingya who are working for Rohingya's right. So this why I am working with the European Rohingya Council.
There is one big challenge still facing Abul, helping his own family. They're currently in detention facing an uncertain future, and for security reasons, he can't visit them.
About my family and my sibling, today they are living in a detention center in a country where there is no human right freedom. So I don't want to use the name of the country. They have been more than 2 years, still there is no decision where they can find their identity. So UNHCR sometime in last 2 years, UNHCR have been visited them 2 times, but the UNHCR said, we cannot identify you are a Rohingya because you haven't any ID. So we don't know what we have to do at the third country settlement or not. So still my sibling, my parents, my wife's parents and her sibling, they are living in detention center. And last year, my wife, she lost her parents in the detention center. So I don't like to describe name of this country. This will be very dangerous for me.
Anita Shug is a neurosurgeon currently living in Switzerland. She left Myanmar around 1985 when her father, a chemical engineer and member of the pro-democracy movement, was forced to leave.
I'm one of the lucky ones to end up in Europe. Not many Rohingyas manage to end up in Europe. It's because you have to take many difficult routes. Bangladesh and Europe is very far away. Myanmar and Europe is very far away.
One night, she joined her mother and older sister on a journey that would go on to test both their physical strength as well as her resilience to carry on.
Our long journey started from Myanmar. Unfortunately, we were living with our grandparents, and one day, because of the security threat, first my father left and then we. And I remember very clearly it was very dark, late at night, and my mom and me and my elder sister, three of us, We secretly took a rickety boat. I remember very carefully and very clearly that my grandma, we could not say goodbye to her because she will cry. So she was locked inside the house and we had to secretly move and towards the boat. There were some people waiting for us together with other people who were fleeing the land. And before we reached, we headed for Bangladesh. In between, we were met by security forces. There were some negotiations between them. I don't know who has done that. I was very small. But I could sense that there were some security negotiations between the border guard police and the people who were taking us towards Bangladesh. And I'm sure that there were some exchange of money that you have to give, the price you have to pay to leave the country. And before we reached the shores of Bangladesh, the boat started to fill in with water. I was very small. My mom caught hold of my elder sister. And I'm sorry if I break down because it's a traumatic event for me. And I try to control my tears, but sometimes I cannot. And I'm really sorry about that. So, and the boat started to sink. And somebody pulled me out of the water and carried me on his shoulder. Then we reached the shores. We stayed. We could not reveal that we are Rohingya and we are Burmese. We stayed hiding in Bangladesh, having very little to eat. Even my mom, she had to stay without food because her portion of food, what she had to share with us to fill our hungry tummies. There were a few months we had to stay in Bangladesh, and from there we walked here to Pakistan. It was very difficult. There were other people with us, and on our way to Pakistan, there were a few grandparents who were carrying their grandchildren. Among them, young girls like around age 10 or 12. And because the journey was very difficult, it was very physically very challenging. Some of the old people, they even sold their grandchildren to on their way to Karachi to old people. It was not, I believe, retrospectively, I believe it was not that they wanted money, but they tried. I believe that these people, they sold their grandchildren. Not for the money, but to give them a secured life, that because they knew both of them or all of them together will not survive the long distance. And we stayed some years in Pakistan. And from Pakistan, we joined our auntie who left Burma before independence. And she has given us shelter. Unfortunately, this aunt who has provided us shelter, she died 3 weeks ago this year. She turned 92. She has given a lot of shelter to many Rohingyas who have fled military persecution. And from Pakistan, we joined our father who got a job in Saudi Arabia as a chemical engineer. We stayed there many years. And where we had our education, and from Saudi Arabia we went to Dubai. I had my A-levels done there, and from there I left my parents' home and pursued my medical education partly in Ukraine and partly in Saudi Arabia, and then to have a postgraduate education I left for England. I worked in England for a few years, and then in pursuit of better training, I came to Germany. And from Germany, for the last 2 years, I'm in Switzerland. That's a part of my story, to make it short.
What was it like coming to Europe?
You know, when you are stateless, when you lose your motherland, when you lose your community and you're not welcome there and you have no choice but to leave because of fear for your life, then you keep on traveling, because stateless people, they don't end up in one country. Most of them, they have to travel, keep on traveling to different places till they find that they are somewhere welcome, that they can call that place their home, that they have roots in that place. So I never thought I will be traveling to Europe. I was happy with whatever little I had. In Saudi Arabia, working as a doctor, I faced one particular difficulty. The people are very nice there, no doubt. But the system, it does not accept foreign doctors to get postgraduate education. And this was the reason why I said, I can't be a general practitioner all my life. I want something more. I want something challenging. So Europe has been very open to foreigners, and they have one of the best education system, one of the best training medical system. And that's why I decided I will apply for licensing exam, and then I will pursue my postgraduate education in England. And fortunately, I was successful, and I worked in Birmingham, I worked in Portsmouth, I worked in Belfast, and I gathered a lot of good skills, good knowledge in medical field. But also I found out that England, for example, is very open. It is open to foreigners. They accept diverse community. They integrate them easily, and they accept who you are. And this thing I have found in Germany, in Switzerland, European as a whole, they believe in human dignity, they believe in universal human rights, which unfortunately we are denied in Burma as an ethnic Rohingya minority.
Do you still have family in Myanmar that you still keep in contact with?
Close family members, my relatives, scattered all around Arakan or Rakhine State. I keep in close communication with them, I'm in touch with them. Firstly, because I want to show them the moral support, and I want to be there in the worst humanitarian time of our Rohingya history. Unfortunately, each and every communication, it ends up as if it will be our last goodbye. My relatives, my aunts, my cousins, they are living under constant fear. The situation has gone so worse that they wake up very early in the morning. They have once a day, only one meal, single meal, which is breakfast, which is dinner, which is supper, which is lunch. Then they are ready in a flight mode. Something will happen that they can run and escape, or they can at least try to save themselves. The worst part, once I had to confront with a question from my cousin who's 6 years old. He wanted from my side that he is assured that the military will not attack their village and will not attack them. But I had to keep quiet, because I cannot assure or give this little boy false hope that they will not be attacked. And unfortunately, in 2017, the Burmese military has targeted babies and children, which I think does not justify in any court that children should be targeted, elderly women should be targeted, young girls should be targeted in the name of clearance operations.
How did you feel about seeing the recent crisis unfold on screens and social media?
When you ask about the news and videos, what we see in the media, it's very difficult for us, because it's not only the video which you see, it's not only the visual aspect of the violence which you have to see, but also, for example, the cries, the voices of people crying, the children crying, screaming for help. Every tone has terror in it, every tone has a message in it. And being a Rohingya, it is worse to see these human tragedy, and sitting far away from them and not being able to do anything is the worst. So I wish I could be there physically there to help our people who are in dire conditions, who are screaming to be saved.
These are the stories of only two Rohingya, just two in a possible 3.5 million tales. They speak of harrowing escapes and the testing journeys which brought them to this day. Yet, living so far from the current crisis, they're still deeply affected by and connected to its events. That's why they're trying to raise awareness. They want to help them. They want to prepare them for the future. For now, that future is still unknown. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can also follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can donate to help us help Rohingya refugees. From all of us here at Moas, goodbye.